I'm Donna Fiducia, along with Don Newen. And our special guest for this next half hour is making his debut appearance here on Cowboy Logic Radio. I'm talking about Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangiri. He is Iranian-born. He immigrated to the United States at the age of 10 after the Iranian Revolution. And the colonel is a retired U.S. Army colonel who saw extensive combat in the Middle East as a Special Ops Forces soldier. And after retirement, he continues to advise the fledgling Assyrian Christian Army in Iraq, known as Dawak Nasha, hope I said that properly, with his military expertise. You can find his website, nec-se.com. Again, that is the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, LLC, and also founder of the United Assyrian Appeal, and that would be unitedassyrianappeal.org. Colonel, thank you for joining us here on Cowboy Logic Radio.
It's good to be here.
Let me ask you this. Your mission basically right now is trying to stop the Assyrian genocide before it's too late. Can you explain, first of all, Assyrian is actually Iranian, but can you just explain what an Assyrian essentially is in today's terms?
Yes, Assyrians, modern Assyrians are the descendants of the ancient Assyrians, the ancient Assyrian Empire that ruled the entire Middle East region as we know it today, to include extending all the way into Egypt. Now, modern Assyrians still are tied to the ancient Assyrians, but of course, as a nation, it was the first nation to ever fully accept Christianity before any other nation ever did. And when Christianity spread throughout the Middle East into Mongolia, even into China, and all the way into Japan, it was the Assyrian Church of the East that expanded it to include into India. So the Assyrians, who speak Aramaic, which is Akkadian spoken, ancient Assyrian language, and modern Aramaic or Syriac are the descendants of the ancient Assyrians, and they are the keepers of the root of the Christianity. Jesus Christ spoke Aramaic, and what the Assyrians did, they practiced the traditions of what Jesus spoke about in their daily life, which is one of the reasons ISIS has targeted them, and they have been targeted going back to when the Ottomans killed the Armenians, killed the Pontic Greeks. They also killed 750,000 Assyrians in the first genocide of the 20th century. It was the Assyrians fighting under the leadership of Agapotros that broke the back of the Ottoman armies in northern Iran today, southern Turkey and Iraq. It was the Assyrians that fought as British levy that actually secured the borders of what is modern Iraq with the promise that they were going to get their homeland, but the British, under the Sykes-Picot Agreement with the French, turned around and betrayed the Assyrian Christians. In World War II, the Assyrian Christians fought against the Nazis and ensured that the Germans could not take the Mosul oil fields in northern Iraq. And if they had, we may be talking about a different history as to Germany being able to establish its network of getting its oil from northern Iraq and not having to attack Russia into going into the Caucasus to be able to secure that oil. Because of that, the Assyrians have gone through a genocide almost every 20 years. And the most recent was the 2014 genocide, where the Assyrians were killed for their religion and their ethnicity, both in Syria and Iraq.
I got to tell you, Colonel, and I'm not saying anything you obviously don't know. The Middle East as a region is without a doubt, both historically and politically, the most complex, difficult region to be able to wrap your head around, to be able to understand all of this stuff. I mean, just historically, with you and the subject matter experts that we've had on our show over the past 6 or 7 years, I still can't wrap my head around it. It is so damn complex. Now, what can the listeners do to follow and understand the work that you're doing with regard to the Assyrians, and how can they help?
Well, for us, I established the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement on September 11, 2014, in the honor of the 3,000 Americans that were murdered on our soil. And since then, we tried to teach readers as to how to use what we call linked analysis to understand how everything is linked together and how they can start looking at what we call friction points within the various different issues and topics that are covered on the Middle East to much better be able to comprehend it and be able to have a broader perspective on it. Same way, when we established the United Assyrian Appeal, we realized that because of these complexities, U.S. was not going to support any type of Assyrian military Christian force structure in Iraq and Syria in order for them to be able to defend themselves against this genocide. Because of that, we established the United Assyrian Appeal. We collected money from the military families, which allowed the fighters to fight on the battlefield. The army that you know of as Dwichnosha, what you may have seen in open source, was nothing more than a small glimpse into who they were. But on the battlefield, they conducted unilateral operations with no support from the U.S. or any of our adversaries, whether it be Russia or China or anyone else in the region, on their own. And we funded that small capability through United Assyrian Appeal by taking care of their families, basically, with humanitarian aids and needs, and they were able to fight on those battlefields. They were so successful that prior to ISIS attacking France, declaring war against them, they also declared war in the same magazine against the Assyrian army, which is referred to as the Dwichnosha by open sources. The problem we have is that we invest in sometimes the lowest hanging fruits. We don't understand the complexities of this fabric that lays over the Middle East that is 6,000 years old. And unfortunately, because of that and because of the fact that we don't understand the human terrain, it is very difficult for us sometimes within the foreign policy concept of the U.S., which is really a two-year foreign policy given how Congress changes over, to be able to have any type of a coherent policy within the region regardless of who's in the executive.
Before we get into what's going on currently with regard to Iran and how much that's been in the news of late, I want to ask your expert opinion on one thing. As a warrior, as a lieutenant colonel in the United States Army, having listened to the former administration, the Obama administration, label ISIS as the JV team, and now hearing the Obama administration declare that ISIS has been decimated.
Trump administration.
I'm sorry. What did I just
say? You said Obama twice.
Okay, sorry about that. The Trump administration declaring that ISIS has been decimated. What are your views as a warrior on that? Has ISIS been decimated? I don't think they ever were a JV team, quite honestly, in my opinion. JV teams don't put people in cages and light them on fire. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's this... what led to ISIS is the same thing that led to Al-Qaeda Iraq, which led to Al-Qaeda itself, which led to why the Assyrian Christians 100 years ago were butchered, why in 1933 the Iraqi military, for the first time in the history of that nation and the first time in the history of modern mankind, a ethnical community was killed, not just because of their religion, but because of their ethnicity also, outside of any type of a civil war and outside of any type of a major conflict that the globe was dealing with. And that philosophy is what ISIS is. And those are the embers that allow these type of organizations to come. Look, in 2006, when I was in the battlefields of Iraq, between 2006-2007, I had my Special Operational Forces team in Al Anbar, we were picking up folks. Some were saying that we're Al-Qaeda Iraq. The other ones were saying we're ISIS. So we didn't know what this ISIS was, but we knew that mentality-wise, they were no different than Al-Qaeda Iraq and no different than Al-Qaeda. They were just a little bit more brutal in their wants and desires. So This you could defeat ISIS on the battlefield, but defeating the ideology is the
exactly.
problem, because nobody understands it and nobody knows how to fight off of that 6-inch battlefield that is between somebody's eyeballs.
That's what I was going to ask you. Is it a religious? I mean, we're talking about when they say Islamic extremism, it's not extremism. It is what Islam calls for, and that is the caliphate, correct? And Sharia law.
Well, Islam calls for a caliphate. Where the problem intensifies is the fact that what is happening in the Middle East is also internal context of what happened when initially Muhammad tried to establish the religion of Islam. The Arab concept ran into what is called the Persian mind. And although the Persians are Muslims, they're Shia now, the Arab is a majority Sunni, the Arab concept could not understand why the Persian taught the way he did. So this conflict that led to this internal bleeding out in Islam, where Shia and Sunni has been killing each other for years, then made its way into the world polities that were established after the Ottoman Empire fell, where Turkey saw itself as being the lead of Islam as far as the caliphate is concerned, Saudi holding all the Islamic institution saw itself as the lead of Islam, and Iran saw itself as the lead of Islam for Shia Islam. So a lot of the fighting that's taking place in the Middle East happens to be these polities fighting and jockeying to see who would be the lead of Islam. We wrote an article in the Near East going back a couple of years now, and we said, who should speak for Islam? You know, in the Christian faith, we have multiple denominations. But even given those multiple denominations, different viewpoints, the one entity that usually gets the political platform to speak on issues globally is the Roman Catholic Church. And the Pope can stand at the UN and speak on behalf of Christianity. The Pope can come to the Capitol and meet with the president and speak about Christianity. And there's a voice there. Islam doesn't have that. It doesn't have that one focal point. And infighting, the cultural differences between the Arab and the Persian, the polities fighting each other is why the Middle East is constantly at war with itself.
I want to get to your Daily Herald piece that you wrote on July 7th to understand foreign policy, understand the backyard wars. But let me first reintroduce you. We're talking to Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangiri. He is Iranian-born. He immigrated to the United States at the age of 10 after the Iranian Revolution. He
yeah,
is
let's
a-
put that into perspective. 1980, correct, sir?
Correct. We had come up here a couple of years prior, but when we went back, the revolution started. We ended up migrating. So by 1980 would be the date that we would go with.
Needless to say, your perspective is quite unique. You're a retired U.S. Army colonel, but you saw extensive combat in the Middle East as a Special Ops Forces soldier, and after retirement, continues to advise the fledgling Assyrian Christian Army in Iraq. You are the CEO of the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, and what they try to do is both academic and operational as an institution that relies on experts for diplomacy and for information to try to help the Assyrian population. Can we talk a little bit about this backyard wars? You touched on it obviously briefly, but you've got the United States in there, Russia's been in there, we're all trying to meddle, and it's sort of, I look at it like the Hatfields and the McCoys, because it goes back so deeply, and it is such a strategic area for the whole world, but it's also quite complex, and it's just so hard to try to wrap our minds around what's going on there.
Yes, the Daily Herald staff, editorial staff, reached out to me and said, look, we've seen some of your interviews, we've read some of the articles, we think you have a different type of a perspective than what we see in the main press. Could you give us an insight maybe that the common person might be able to better understand foreign policy? And the way I try to get that point across is that everybody has a backyard, at least. Everybody has an opportunity to have a backyard in their house. And our backyard is where we put the most precious things that we have, spend the time with our family, secure it to make sure that nobody enters it. And when people enter our backyard, to us is almost like them entering our homes. And that's how the nations look at the other nations are around them as far as being their backyard. So when Russia goes into Venezuela, we see that as a threat to us. When we go into Middle East or we go into Armenia and the Southern Caucasus, that's how they see themselves too, from the Russian perspective. These are the reasons why nations really are at odds with each other. The problem is that today's backyard has extended from what it used to be. So the Middle East is now our backyard, too. As an example, when we decide to strike a deal with Iran under the previous administration, or we were trying to strike a new deal with Iran under the current administration, it's no longer just us and Iran and us being in the backyard of the Russians. China sees the Middle East as its backyard. Russia sees the Middle East as its backyard. When we negotiate with them, Europe sees it as their backyard. The negotiation that we have is not just with Iran, it's with with various different organizations that are tied to Iran, various different polities. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, which Iran is part of, also becomes part of that backyard negotiations. And all these different economic and political realities of war extend some of these friction points, which makes it very difficult for us to be able to have possibly a coherent foreign policy within these backyards. And my push is that if we are okay with others operating in our backyard for our interests, then it actually would make a modern world much easier place for us to be able to negotiate trade deals, deals on governance, and deals on security that would benefit all of us in the long run.
You know, I'm going to come right out and say I thought the dumbest thing that Obama did, and he did a lot of dumb things, and that was giving Iran $150 billion and thinking, oh, well, they're just going to use it for peaceful purposes. Well, what do they need nukes for? They got more oil than just about any country there, and very good oil. So, again, that was water under the bridge. I'm sure that money is being used against us. So Trump stops that deal. Now he starts, you know, the saber rattling starts a little bit. Possibly a drone shot down or not, then we shoot down another drone. It's starting to escalate, and then all of a sudden, boom, we have British tankers being seized. What's your take on that? And if you were advising President Trump, what would you tell him?
We have advised the National Security Council before. Our recommendation is that you cannot win with the partners you have in the region and with the foreign policy that you have. Literally, the partners we have in the region, we buy off. We give them money, and that's what Obama did. He gave money trying to buy off the Iranians for the benefit of what he thought was a U.S. perspective. In 2012, the Obama administration bought into a concept that China had introduced for the United States and China to be able to be global leaders in the long run within within not just the region, their own regions, but also within these conflict regions like the Middle East or Africa. Well, the administration bought into that, started moving its policies forward in that direction. The problem we ran into, and Near East was the first one to say this was never a nuclear deal, this was an economic deal, where we were trying to develop the bazaar of Iran for the next 20 years. Well, we struck that deal, as we wrote on the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement, to save Europe at the time, because Europe economically was failing. Europe bypassed our agreements with Iran. And as an example, when we struck that deal, the first group of individuals that showed up in Iran were the American oil men, trying to strike future businesses with Iranian oil. Followed us were the Europeans. The Europeans, however, went in. And on the ground, even operationally, the major companies would go in, pay off protesters to stand in the streets and scream "Death to America." Then they would go into the meeting and tell the Iranian businesses, why do you want to strike a deal with the American companies? Listen, your own people are screaming "Death to America." Have the American businesses come through us. Obama never figured that the Europeans would try to circumvent us by actually striking those deals, forcing us to have to come to them, rather than appreciating the fact that we struck that deal to save Europe. Today, the Europeans are the ones that are putting pressure on us when it comes to economic sanctions under the current administration. Britain, France, and Germany have been the major violators of the sanctions. As much as they say they're helping us, an example, when the British seized the Iranian tanker, that's more of an information operational campaign for the British to be able to say that, look, we're supporting the United States. But technically, the reason why they secured that tanker was because they were trying to negotiate the release of their hostage in Iran. And that tanker was going to be flipped for the release of their hostage. The British have been using information operations and know how to maneuver through the political landscape for years, much better than the U.S. has ever been able to do in the short lifespan that we've had as a nation. Now that the Iranians have seized the oil tankers that the British had, trying to force their hand in that negotiation to ensure that they keep the hostages and possibly get their tankers back. From a U.S. perspective, the problem we have is the British turn around and say, look, we seized the oil tanker in support of U.S. security requirements, but our oil tankers get seized and you're not doing anything for us. Underneath all this, when you look at it, even if there's a future regime change in Iran, we believe that we could take our Iranian Americans and maybe place them into Iran where we could force a political change in the future once this regime change has taken place in order to support American wants and desires perspectives in the region. However, the British, because their visa requirements have been much more lax, have been educating the sons and daughters and family members of every Iranian who is a major and above in the Iranian army and British schools. So in the future, if there's a regime change, this is a way that Britain would be able to have much more of a solid relationship with Iran than us, which is the reason why China is trying to not strike deals in Europe to ensure that Europe has a way to buck back against the U.S. in the long run, and they won't be dependent on us for the longer vision as far as economics are concerned. These are the maturations that take place. And in this process, what happens, the small, young Assyrian Christian on the ground is getting absolutely trampled because the elephants are fighting each other, adversaries and even allies, to control the region. Remember, at the basic, if you want to look at it from a cowboy perspective, the British had their guy in Iran who was the father of the Shah. The Americans went in and replaced them and controlled Iran for a number of years, economically developing that location for our benefit. And now the British have learned through negotiations with Iran under simple policies to be able to hopefully in the future get the control back of Iran, which they initially lost when the U.S. replaced the Shah of Iran with his son. These internal fightings and maturations are the things we need to be aware of and cognizant of when we're dealing both with our adversaries and our allies and why we are where we are today.
Wow. I had no idea. And that was extremely informative. It's almost like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, though, because with what's going on now with these seized British tankers, the U.S., Saudi Arabia, the UAE, among others, are all joining together against Iran. And I believe with the sanctions that Trump did put in, Iran is hurting economically. The people obviously want regime change. Thank God Egypt was smart enough to get rid of the Muslim Brotherhood years ago. The Iranian young people want that same thing. And can you see that possibly happening at this point?
Yes, regime change is possible. It might be bloody, but it is possible. The one thing keep in mind, though, the Iranian government is an Islamic republic, and it will continue to be an Islamic republic even under a new regime change. So whatever decisions they make in the long run for their nation has to meet the requirements of what an Islamic republic has. And that means that it has to initially, everything that you write into law has to bounce off of the Islamic law before it could be cauterized. So these are the issues that non-Islamic minorities and groups within the region would have to constantly deal with. As far as the, again, we go back to the issue of our allies. Every nation, as much as they want to be our ally, is not going to be our ally unless they see something for their interest. And we have to be savvy enough to understand that sometimes when they come and stand with us, they're not doing it because they care for us. They're doing it because there's a need for them. If you look at Saudi Arabia striking deals with Israel now and even allowing the Israelis to have flyover capability on their territory, it doesn't mean that Saudi Arabia has suddenly changed and doesn't believe in the destruction of the Jewish state any longer. It's because Iran is a major threat in the region and Saudi needs Israel to sustain its kingdom. If Saudi cared about the Israelis, where was Saudi 40 years ago when Imam Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini came in and said that the way to Israel or Jerusalem is through Karbala, and started expanding Iranian ability to affect Iraq, to affect Syria, to affect Lebanon, to where now you have close to 150,000 missiles sitting on the border of Syria and Israel, and 200,000 sitting on the border of Lebanon and Israel. As far as Saudi was concerned, they could care less if the Jewish state ceased to exist. It was part of what their philosophy is. They're only doing that now is because they realize that they cannot survive if they don't strike this near-term security requirement.
Absolutely. Colonel, tell everybody how they can get in touch with you and your mission to stop the Assyrian genocide before it's too late.
The biggest thing for us is that if they can support us through United Assyrian Appeal, we have pulled the Assyrian military forces of Dothmoshe off the battlefield. Why? Because the Sunni Muslim Kurds and the Arab in Iraq were going to fight each other, and they will continue to fight each other. And we didn't want our army capability to be stuck in the middle of having to choose a side. We can always reconstitute them, bring them back on the battlefield, but for now, we are taking care of their multi-families, getting ready for the day when finally there's an Assyrian Christian safe haven or a Assyrian Christian state, possibly, in northern Iraq, which will allow us to now take over all security measures to protect the Assyrian Christians in the region.
From your lips to God's ears.
Let
me give everybody your website, because unfortunately we're out of time. Sargis Sangiri, again, Iranian-born and a special ops forces soldier here in the United States as he immigrated to the United States at the age of 10. The website, again, is the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement. So you don't have to write it out. Just get the initials, NEC-SE.com, NEC-SE. SE.com and UnitedAssyrianAppeal.org. Colonel, thank you so much for joining us here on Cowboy Logic Radio. We got to have you back again. This is wonderful.
Anytime. I hope it helps.